Good evening, everyone, here at the Zendo on Wall Street and out there in the Zoom realm, wherever you are. It's a little harder to read people's names from this distance, but I almost can. I can pretty much identify who's out there. It's still a wonder, even after 3 years. Very soon it will be 3 years. 3 years since we started this Zoom adventure. Who would have imagined? So tonight is the sixth and final week of a series that we've been doing on a text called 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. So don't worry if you've missed any or all of the previous talks. They are online if you want to catch up. This is a text from the 14th century by a Tibetan Buddhist master, Tokme Zongpo. And these verses are in the Tibetan tradition of Lojong teachings, which are pretty straightforward instructions, often in the form of numbered verses, that tell us how to train our minds to release the harmful habit patterns of thought, speech, and action that cause us and others so much suffering, and how to cultivate beneficial ways of living in this very difficult world. The verses offer practices. They're quite pragmatic. The practices that lead to deep freedom for ourselves and others. They're meant for ordinary people, and these practices sound deceptively simple in language, but they are lifetime practices. They're good for the long haul. Of a whole lifetime. And up to now, the sequence that we've been following, the verses have presented a kind of framework or scaffolding for our practice. From the basic components of establishing a meditation practice to dealing with afflictive emotional states that arise in everyday life, to the powerful compassion practice of Tonglen, giving and sending, opening the heart to suffering, to our own suffering and to others. And then last week, Michael talked about the paramitas, or the perfections. These are qualities that we cultivate on the bodhisattva path. Generosity, patience, ethical conduct, energy, concentration, and wisdom. So through these verses, we're sort of accumulating a Dharma toolkit, you could say. This last sequence that I'm going to talk about today seems to me to be Tokme Zongpo's final cautions. He's giving us pointers to be careful of, particularly if we find ourselves becoming a little bit complacent or self-satisfied in our practice, or just kind of coasting along, or if we start to feel like we're getting, you know, looking down on others who aren't quite as advanced as we are, that sort of thing. He's showing us the booby traps that we can fall into if we get caught up in status and achievement, even in our Dharma practice, and if we're not scrupulously honest with ourselves. And so these verses that we're going to look at tonight apply to all kinds of human social relationships, from family and friends to workplace to Sangha. So let's take a look at what he has to say, starting with verse 31. See if you can find verse 31. And Sasha's going to screen share that for the Zoom folks. There it is. Okay, so it says, if you don't go into your own confusion, and we could also say delusion here, I think, is maybe a little bit better word. If you don't go into your own delusion, you may be just a materialist in practitioner's clothing. Constantly go into your own delusion and put an end to it. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So what he's saying here is it's not enough to read all the right Dharma books, to learn all the Zendo forms and how to do everything just right, or to be able to talk the talk, you know, to say all the right things to impress somebody. We have to be willing to look very directly at our own delusions and distortions of mind and speech and action, and look deeply into the roots, into the causes and conditions that give rise to those distortions, and into the nature of our mind, of our conditioned mind, and to let go, to recognize those distortions and confusions for what they are, and in that beautiful expression, open the hand of thought, or even relax our grip a little. Because otherwise we're caught up in what's been called spiritual materialism. We can take those sort of socially conditioned expectations for accomplishment and status and carry them into our spiritual practice. Ken MacLeod, who's a contemporary teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, writes a really excellent commentary on these verses, and we've been quoting him at times. And he says, ask yourself, are you a materialist in practitioner's clothing? It all boils down to one principle, he says. Do you practice to improve the situation of your life? Or do you use the situation of your life to practice? That sounds almost the same, doesn't it? But it's not. You might say, well, what's the difference? But using practice to fix or improve your life is setting yourself up for disappointment and dissatisfaction, because we live in a world of great suffering. So how could we be so arrogant as to think that we could fix our life perfectly living in this world? Our practice is to use the situations that arise in our lives in this world to see deeply into the nature of being, to see deeply into the impermanent, conditioned, and interconnected nature of being, and let go of our self-focus, our self-preoccupation. So to use the situations that arise to practice, to manifest our practice. When we do that, and we allow when we allow our practice to feed our kind of ego identification and agenda to make our lives better, then we're apt to slip into that mind of achievement, and we're apt to slip into judging and criticizing others. And that's the caution in the next verse. Let's look at the next one, 32. You undermine yourself when you react emotionally and grumble about the imperfections of other bodhisattvas, of the imperfections of those who have entered the great way. Don't say anything. This is the practice of the bodhisattva. So the Buddha taught that the comparing mind is the mind of self-clinging, of self. Of the ego. So our culture, our society really reinforces that we're always thinking, we're always comparing, are we better than, are we worse than, are we just as good as, or just as bad as? And the Buddha says that's all vanity. I really like Ken MacLeod's commentary on this. I could not say it any better, so I'm going to share some of his comments with you. He says, people start doubting you when you disparage those who are regarded as very knowledgeable or capable. They see you as competitive and mean-spirited when you demean your peers. And when you criticize those who are less knowledgeable and capable than you, people wonder why you're not teaching or helping those you're criticizing. So better than, just as good as, worse than. It's all a kind of, those comparisons are kind of self-reinforcing. When you grumble about how this person is doing this wrong and that person is doing that wrong, people soon stop listening to you. They grow tired of you undermining their trust, the friendship or appreciation they have for those people, and they lose any trust they had in you. What do you gain here? No matter how valid your criticism, you are a self-appointed expert. You may not know it, but you are revealing to others how arrogant and envious you are. You hope to prove that you are intelligent, knowledgeable, skilled, creative, strong, courageous, or honest. Your criticism of others demonstrates that you are insecure in those ways. When you're really, truly confident in your own knowledge, skill, or creativity, you do not need to prove anything. You have no need to be critical and grumble about the imperfections of others. You can instead offer support, guidance, and encouragement. You may think you are holding yourself to a higher standard, not like those others, and yet the critical mind is devoid of joy, empathy, or compassion. This is so important. So important. For us to just simply stop and take a few breaths when that critical mind arises and step aside, give ourselves some space to feel what's underneath that. What's going on inside us? What's being threatened by whatever way that other person is? What piece of our ego identity is being threatened? Some insecurity about our own ability or status? And how can we rest in that discomfort and let it ease? American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, Pema Chodron, calls that finding your tender spot. Realizing your own vulnerability, finding that tender spot and just staying present with a sense of kindness and ease to your own vulnerability. So often when we're, you know, criticizing others harshly, we're reinforcing our own defenses. So if we do that practice of just stopping, just realizing when that mind of criticizing arises, to just pause, refrain, breathe, and feel into our own discomfort. Rather than saying those cutting and harmful words. It's quite a strong practice. So the next verse extends this same theme. Verse 33, when you squabble with others about status and rewards, you undermine learning, reflection, and meditation. Let go of any investment in your family circle or the circle of those who support you. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So again, he's talking about competition, you know, our conditioning to be competitive, whether in, you know, everywhere from sibling relationships to the highest levels of government or corporate culture. That person is getting more praise and recognition than I am after I've done all this work. They're just showing off. Whether in our family growing up, you were the one who could do no wrong or the one who could do no right. Whether you were the artistic one, or the brainy one, or the stupid one, the talented one, or the clumsy one. These stereotypes and jealousies that arise leave their mark on us, don't they? We're lucky if we came through childhood without any of those marks. And yet those marks are ultimately phantoms. No substantial reality. Creations that we continue to maintain and reinforce, even though we hate being bound by them. And it can come as a surprise sometimes to realize, I don't know if this has ever happened to any of you, that as an adult, decades later, that your peers or friends actually don't see you in that way that you were seen as a child. Oh, oh, maybe that's not so true. When I catch myself spinning my wheels in the rut of some old habitual story or narrative that I learned early in life, I have to stop and ask myself, is this true? And then I ask again, is this really true? And then I ask myself, you know, if I'm projecting somebody doesn't respect me, or someone doesn't see the real me, and then I have to ask myself, do you really think so poorly of these people that you give them more credit? Give them more credit for having more insight and care. You know, it's a way of disparaging others, in a way, to say that they think poorly of you when they don't. How about trusting others to see us? How about trusting others to see us as whole people? And if they really can't, to know how deeply their view is obscured by their own suffering and conditioning. The next verse deals with one of the eight elements of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught, which is right speech. This is number 34. Abusive language upsets others and undermines the ethics of a bodhisattva. Don't upset people or speak abusively. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. The power of speech is so great that it stands alone as one of the Eightfold Path, along with, there are three of the Eightfold Path that apply particularly to how we live in the world, our right livelihood, right conduct, and right speech. And right speech gets one of its own. And in the 10 what are called the 10 grave precepts of our 16 bodhisattva precepts, three of them have to do with speech. Three out of the 10, specifically with speech, not speaking falsely, not praising self at the expense of others, not inflating the self, and not disparaging others, using kind speech. So we can see, you know, that our human capacity for language has the power to be both a blessing and a curse. And the way to practice right speech is similar to what we've been talking about with these other kinds of reactivity. To pause and ground ourselves in body and breath. Take that backward step, shed the light of awareness on our motivations, the causes and conditions of our reactivity. And in the case of speech, we need to ask ourselves, these are the criteria, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? And is this the right timing? Because if it's not the right timing, it doesn't matter how true it is. You know, and if it's not kind, Yeah, so all, is it kind? Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? And is it timely? And if it's not, or if we're not sure, if we're uncertain, it's better simply to refrain and wait until the right time and the right words are there, and that they come from a deeper and wiser and more compassionate place. Ken MacLeod gives another set of criteria that I've not seen before. And he said, in practicing right speech, there is no distraction, no control, and no work. I've never seen this anywhere else. And no distraction means that you're fully present with the other person. You're not, and you know how often in our everyday lives people are carrying on a conversation in the midst of distraction, right? They're not really listening to each other. No distraction, no control means that you're not sitting there rehearsing what you're going to say while the other person's speaking. You're not rehearsing and strategizing. You're just present and trusting that you will respond in the best way. And then no work means no agenda. You're not trying to accomplish something with your speech. Again, you're just there, fully present, fully listening, and then fully responding. So how different is that from so much of our communication in our typical daily lives? These verses, I feel, are essentially about navigating the treacherous waters of human relationships, which I think over the 3 years of the pandemic, our human relationships have suffered. It seems that in general, and in specific observations, that so many people, and I include myself, feel a little more thin-skinned, a little more vulnerable, quicker to feel uncertain, untrusting, to defend, withdraw, or defend. I think in our eagerness to get back to so-called normal, you know, post-pandemic, that we're underestimating how much relational healing and rehabilitation is needed. I think it's going to take time and deliberate effort to really give care to how we speak and relate to each other. I don't know if any of you have noticed that just in daily lives, whether it's family or workplace or other situations. So this next verse is a kind of summing up, I think, but it needs a little bit of unpacking and perhaps some rewording. This is 35. When reactive emotions build up momentum, it is hard to make remedies work. A present and aware person uses remedies as weapons to crush craving and other emotional reactions as soon as they arise. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So the basic message here is then when we have a kind of reactive emotional emotion arise, our practice is to meet that state that fully and apply what he's calling the remedies of our practice. He's given us a lot of different practices that we can use to be present and to kind of use our experience for insight and opening the heart and mind. But I wonder, does the military metaphor of calling them weapons, using the remedies as weapons, does that really serve us in this day and age? Does it really work to crush our emotions, to bludgeon them into submission? If you've ever tried. In your zazen practice, you know, when you're in retreat and something, you know, a strong emotional state arises, And if you try to suppress it, it just pushes back harder. Whether it's anger, grief, envy, desire, the mind just pushes back. So that kind of weaponizing of our practice seems a kind of almost self-violence. And I appreciate that this metaphor comes from, you know, medieval culture where warfare was the norm. And moral warfare is all too much still the norm in our world today. So my feeling, at least, what I'd like to propose is that we need metaphors of healing rather than warfare. To imagine these remedies as maybe our medicine bag or medicine chest that we reach into when an afflictive state arises, so that we can apply maybe one of the Brahma-Viharas practices, kindness, compassion, equanimity, or joy, or the paramitas that we mentioned, generosity, patience, or simply the practice of sitting in stillness and paying attention, mindfulness, concentration. All these are part of our Dharma medicine bag. And again, not so much to fix our lives, make everything all perfect, but to meet what arises fully and release that kind of self-focused clinging and aversion. And when we do that, the next verse says, 36, in short, in everything you do, question how your mind is, moment by moment. By being constantly present and aware, you bring about what helps others. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. This is so true, so deeply true, that when we have that capacity to be present and aware, to question what's going on here, what is my state, what is this, question how our mind is, then we have the capacity to align our thoughts, our speech, and our actions with our best intentions, with our bodhisattva vows, and be of benefit to others, not by trying to go out and save everybody. I'm going to save everybody. No, it just flows naturally. We are naturally of benefit to others when we unhook ourselves from those self-focused reactivities. And so he closes the 37th verse as a kind of dedication to dispel the suffering of others without limit. With wisdom freed from the three domains, direct all the goodness generated by these efforts to awakening. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this is a kind of reiteration of the bodhisattva's vow to awaken for the benefit of all beings, deeply seeing into the nature of existence. When he says the three domains, those are self, other, and action, which are also known as the three wheels, which are not separate. Self, other, and action, which is the what happens in between, in that relationship. Another way of saying it is in this beautiful line in our Zen meal chant, which some of you know, may we realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Giver, receiver, and gift, self, other, and action, giver, receiver, and gift, that are not separate. So when we say the emptiness of the three wheels, we mean the non-separation, the non-separation. And when we're free from self-clinging, free from all the various hindrances and obstructions that arise, then our speech and action flow creatively without strain in response to all the ever-changing circumstances of our lives. I'll let you, if you want to take the time later to open the PDF on the website of this text, and maybe we'll attach it also to the recording so people can look. This is verse 37, but then there are several verses yet to come that I won't take the time to look at tonight, where he kind of apologizes for any shortcomings of his words, and expresses gratitude to the those who have gone before, and kind of traditional ways of closing a text like this. I hope you've come to appreciate, those of you who've followed along to some extent, to appreciate these verses and this style of Tibetan Lojong teachings. And maybe some of them are not traditionally taught in Zen practice, but I think there are ways that we can incorporate them into our Zen practice skillfully and with a kind of maybe Zen inflection. So you might want to review them. You might want to choose a particular verse or to give a kind of particular mindfulness focus to over a span of a week or so, and see what is revealed to you. You also can write these down in your own language. Really find language that works for you to express something that's in some of these verses for you. Because these Buddhist texts are not, they're not like the Bible or the Quran in being received from a deity as holy texts in that way. These are texts, they're teaching texts that have been given, written by human beings, imperfectly, because they're expressing what's ultimately inexpressible, and yet we have to try with language, and so they've been added to over the years and through different cultures, and in a sense they are ongoing conversations with the wise and compassionate ones who have walked the path before. So we can really participate in these conversations as we practice on and on together with the ancestors. So yeah, I hope you've enjoyed these weeks of the 37 practices. And rather than divide into small groups, we thought tonight we'd just invite people to on Zoom and here in the Zendo to share any reflections or questions that arise for you about these practices, these verses, or just reflections about what's been particularly meaningful to you that's come out of these weeks that we spent with these. So we can just take turns as people can, just raise your hand and share briefly a reflection or a question that you might have. And so let's